meeting. My name is Lisa, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Lisa.
Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speaker Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too, I must have this thing. I'm going to introduce the speaker tonight. I don't know him, but he was recommended to me, and his name is Randy. So I'll listen to his experience.
Hey, my name's Randy Gibson, and I'm a garden variety alcoholic. You know, I was visiting my son in New York in October, and he had to work. I said, well, I'm going to go to an AA meeting. This is in Manhattan. And he said, well, just look. So I looked at the app, and there was this place called Perry Street. I don't know if anybody's been sober, trying to get sober in New York City, but this is a clubhouse that had been here a long time, 50, 60 years. So I walk over there, walk to the place. It's in Greenwich Village. Walk in. It's a small place, really dimly lit. There's about 40 people there. I'm early, so I sit there. And about 1 minute till the time to start, the chairperson shows up. And he says, oh, Tom couldn't make it, whoever Tom was. He looks right at me and says, you want to tell your story? And I'm like, all right. Yeah, so thank God it was only 15 minutes. But so I thought I would read. There's a few things in the big book that I think are really powerful to me. So I could read a lot, but I'm not going to. This is on page 45. And it's talk. It's in Whig Agnostics. Bill wrote it. It says, well, exactly what this book is about. Its main objective is to enable you to find a higher power greater than yourselves, which will solve your problems. Then I flip over to 46, and this is the things I like a lot more. It says, much to our relief, we discovered we did not need to consider another's conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and to effect a contact with them. We found that God does not make too hard terms for those that seek Him. To us, the realm of spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek it. And I love that. I remember that part when I first came to AA, because I'm a pretty spiritual person, probably a pretty religious person, and I thought, wow, that's powerful that God would be so part of this process, yet it doesn't really direct, it being AA, doesn't really direct you on who you have to choose as a God. You do have to choose one, or a higher power at least. I had some notes. Let's see. This is what, a couple hours, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Three. Okay, good. I can get in just under that. Okay, so here we go. I grew up not far from here, down the road, a place in Atlanta called Chastain Park. I don't know if y'all are from here, but that's where I grew up. And went to high school there. If everybody knows, there's an amphitheater, tennis courts. And I grew up a really pretty normal kid. I played a lot of sports. I hung out at the park all the time, whether it was football, baseball. There was a golf course there. I didn't play a lot of golf, but there was a creek that ran through it. And in the summer, I would always walk up and down the creek because people would hit their golf balls in it. And I'd get their golf ball and go sell them at the clubhouse for a quarter. And I'm not a young guy, so you could do pretty well with a quarter back then. One of the parts of the the park, I'll talk a little bit more about it later, was called Junkie's Cove. So that was a good experience for me. My parents were both alcoholics. My dad worked as the general manager of a Cadillac dealership here for my whole life, basically. And I used to say, when I first came into AA, I used to say, you know, he was a highly functioning alcoholic. And he did well, didn't lose his job, didn't go to jail, didn't wreck the car. And that's what I used to say. Oh, I was a highly functioning alcoholic. But the bar is so low for a highly functioning alcoholic, that doesn't really mean much. That means I didn't get fired, I didn't wreck my car, didn't go to jail. So the bar is pretty low for that. I think I had my first drink when I was 12, and I was amazed before I was halfway through. It occurred pretty quickly, though, that I didn't drink like other 12-year-olds. They tended to take it a little more easy. Pretty quickly, my dad, you know, was in World War II. So growing up, his buddies were always over there talking about their exploits. And it was pretty funny. They drank hard, smoked a lot of cigarettes. And so one of the guys in our neighborhood was my dad's best friend. They went to college together up here in Georgia. They were in Chi Phi's. And so that family had a son my age and then a couple more that were older than me. So when the parents would go out of town or went out for the night, his older brothers would take care of us. So they had this big tree house in the backyard. So they'd make us drink beer so we couldn't tell on them because they were drinking beer. And so that started early. You know, drugs are a part of my story. You know, I was just one of those guys where if somebody said, here, take a handful of these, I would just take those and say, what was it? And then, you know, hope I didn't die. But I made it. I think I tried pretty much everything between the time I was 13 and 18. And kind of after that, I was sort of sick of it. So I never really did drugs past about 19. When I got out of high school, I went to this island. A friend of mine's dad ran a hotel in this place called St. Croix. And so a bunch of us went down there. This was a big, huge place, 100 acres, had a golf course, a beach, and a bunch of us went down there. They didn't pay us much, but I was the bartender. And back then, I mean, a bottle of rum was 99 cents. So, you know, a can of Coke was about a dollar. So, you know, the booze was cheaper than the Coke. So when you'd make a rum and Coke, which was pretty popular, you know, it was 90% rum and 10% Coke, a little bit of ice. And so as I was a bartender, I was down there for probably 6 months. Every night we had this house that we kept in the back with two other roommates. And every single day, every day, I woke up, I couldn't remember anything. I could never remember what I'd done the night before. One time we got in this big fight, and I woke up, my jaw was all jacked up. And I was like, man, what happened last night? And they were like, you don't remember when Ole beat the shit out of you? And I'm like, he did? He's like, yeah. And this was this big guy, that longshoreman that worked at the oil refinery. So anyway, but that was kind of the thing. I just thought that was normal to black out. I just thought that was normal. Nobody else blacked out, but I did. And I heard the other day that normal people pass out, alcoholics black out. I should have known back then. And but it didn't take long. I saw, though, one thing that, and I guess this is one of those moments that, you know, God looks after you. He looks after fools, you know, or drunks like me. And so I was bartending, and every night the same people, this was a big round bar, and then the back part had a, you know, where you could swim up from the pool. Every night the same people came and drank, every night. And every night they were shit-faced drunk. I mean, they'd fall asleep at the bar, half the time they just walk out to, there was a green, you know, I said there's a golf course, they just walk out to the green and take a nap for about 4 or 5 hours. And it hit me one day, and I was like, damn, this, I'm going to be just, that's going to be me in about 20 years. And so I wrote my mom a letter, believe it or not, we did that back then. And I said, send me an application for college. And so she sends me this thing, and I applied to Georgia State. That's when you actually filled it out, sent a little check with it. And so I went and I got back to college. Got a degree in accounting. And I'm not sure why, but my dad, he looked at me as I was graduating. He said, son, you just don't seem like the accounting type. And I said, oh, Dad, I love this shit. This is awesome. You know, adding all this stuff up. Because it always all worked out fine in class. It just, you know, didn't so work out so well, you know, in life. But so I got a job after college. And I think I made it about 6 months. I worked for Georgia Power Company. And back then, if you got a job with Georgia Power Company, you were just set for life. I mean, you had to, well, I wasn't going to say you didn't have to do shit, but you had to work. But, I mean, you were going to, all you had to do was just kind of keep it level, and you were going to retire. So after about 2 weeks at this big adding machine, I was already figuring out how many years before I could retire, how many months, how many days, how many minutes. I was just like, shit, I can't do this. And so I joined the Marine Corps. And I went into the Marine Corps initially to fly planes. And I had my life all planned out. I was going to, because I passed all the tests for the Navy, the Air Force, and the Marines. I didn't want to go in the Army because they didn't have the planes I wanted to fly. But I had it all planned out. I was going to fly jets in the Marine Corps. And I was going to get out. I was going to work for Delta and just have my life all planned out. Well, it didn't quite work out that way. And so when I got down to Pensacola, which is where you go for flight school in the Navy and the Marine Corps, I have astigmatism. So it had been about a year since I'd taken all the tests. And so I couldn't pass eye tests. And they said, well, Lieutenant, what do you want to do? You can't fly jets. And I said, well, I want to be in infantry. And at the time, y'all probably don't, might be a little young for this, but this was 1982. The only really war around was in Lebanon. And so I said, shit, I want to go to the units going to Lebanon. And so I knew a guy, a captain who was a friend of mine. And his brother-in-law was the battalion commander for the unit that was going to Lebanon next. They had one slot for a lieutenant. I took it. And so it was a very interesting experience. I stayed in the Marine Corps about 6 years. The first time I went, we were going to Lebanon. We're out in the ocean. The ship makes this really hard turn in the middle of the night. And so we end up off the this little island called Grenada. This was 1983. And most of y'all are not going to know this. Maybe probably weren't even born in 1983. But we invaded Grenada. Ronald Reagan decided, you know, whatever's going on down there, he didn't like. So he wanted the Marines to go in and straighten the place out. And I remember it was like 4 in the morning. And so we were down on this hangar deck. And, you know, the Navy hated to get, they hated to get shit out they were going to have to put back up, like ammunition. So when they started breaking out ammunition and handing it to us, I was like, wow, this is pretty serious. So here we are, we're loading our magazines, we're putting hand grenades on. And I was like, wow, this is really going to happen. Get on these helicopters, still dark. So we fly in. And I don't know if you've seen these helicopters. They're horribly loud. You can't hear anything in the back of these things. It's just deafening. I can't even hear half the things that I should now because of it. So we swing in. It's dark. You can smell that we're close to the land. You can't see it, but you can smell it. And all of a sudden, the door gunners, who these guys on the sides, start blasting off their machine guns. And I'm like, oh, shit. And so, you know, I'm a lieutenant. I'm in charge of these 50 guys on this thing. And they are all looking at me. Hey, these are kids. They're looking at me going, all right, Lieutenant, what's going on now? You know, what's the next step? We get off that thing and run as fast as we can. And I just remember all those guys looking at me and like, you know, I'm just as scared as you are, guys. So, you know, anyway. But we ended up there, and I had a lot of cool adventures there. Some of you may not think they were that cool. But we ended up at this little checkpoint north of this little town called St. George's. And I wasn't really doing all the checking, but, you know, all the cars, all the people that would come by, we would search them. And there was a kind of a word that had gotten out that a lot of the army from Grenada had deserted. And we found these places where they had just dropped all their uniforms. But the word was they kept their shoes. They kept their boots. So be on the lookout for these people with, you know, army boots. So I just happened to be, it was about 5:30 one morning. It was light. And I just happened to be there. This guy pulls up in this truck. And so I look down in there. And sure enough, he's got those boots on. And you gotta think. I mean, I had a shotgun, a sawed-off shotgun. I had a pistol. I had an M16. I had probably 6 hand grenades, and I was just a bad motherfucker. It was just you just didn't want to fuck with me. I know I'm not supposed to cuss, but it just seemed right. But I mean, you'd look at me and go, "I'm not going to mess with that guy." But he wasn't that smart. So I look down again, and right there is a pistol. He reached for that pistol, and sort of like that, I pulled out my .45 and I shot him right in the lungs. And I don't know if you ever shot anybody with a .45, but it's not pleasant to be on the business end of that. And it's not too pleasant on my end because his guts kind of sprayed all over you. But I say that just because these are sort of defining moments in people's lives. And so, anyway, just thought I'd tell you that. Another funny story, though, not necessarily a drunk log, but so after a few days, it kind of calmed down in Grenada. We're at this little checkpoint, and people start going in and out. I mean, walking back. This is a little tiny road. There's a cliff over here, and, you know, kind of a hill here. And these people, now you're starting to recognize. I was like, wait, didn't those 4 people just walk by here? And so people start, now they're coming back with chairs and sofas and stuff. So they're looting the town. And I'm just like, you know, people are like, what do you want to do? I'm like, fuck, I don't care. Let them come. I don't want that stuff. So that went on for a couple days. And then one morning, I happened to be standing out there. Here comes this guy walking out. You're not going to believe this, but it's so true. It's unbelievable. He's walking up like the road like this with this big, heavy box with some bags in it. And I'm looking at him. And remember what I look like. You know, I'm not the person you want to mess with. And so he comes up. Well, he had robbed the bank. And I'm not kidding you. Everything he had in his hands like this was money. And it probably weighed 60, 70 pounds of money. This was bank money. It was all folded up, brand new dollar bills, whatever. And so I'm like, man, dude, what are you doing? And so he just kind of goes like this, you know, gives me like, well, just rob the bank. And so he hands me a stack like this, like, here, take this. And I'm like, dude, I do not want your money. I thought, God, that's the last thing I want to do, you know, go to jail for that. And I said, I want you to get your money and get out of here. And I let him go. And there's no telling how much money he had. But I wonder if he lived a better life because of it. After we left, I was in combat twice with the Marine Corps. The second time we were in Lebanon, and y'all aren't going to remember this again. We had gotten there. We were spread out. We were ashore, and this was October 23rd, 1983. And I remember that because that's my birthday. That is the day where a terrorist drove under the barracks and blew up and killed 241 Marines. I knew them. They weren't like all my friends, but there was plenty of them that were. And it was just horrible. I mean, it was the largest explosion since World War II. I mean, just to describe. A few months after that, the building was just gone. I mean, literally rubble. And A few months after that, I was in the parking lot next to the building. That's where the helicopters would land. So I had to go back out to the ship for something. And I saw something floating in the air, and it was a piece of uniform. Piece of Marine's uniform that had been stuck up in the trees. And on the back side of this was skin seared to this uniform. Seared. These people got vaporized. Literally vaporized. It's horrible. These were kids. These were 18, 19, 20-year-olds. You know, they never got a chance to be a dad. Never got a chance to be a brother anymore. And that's what I think about on my birthday. All right. Well, I went on. I had about five of my troops there get killed. I got wounded twice. One time I got blown about 30 feet from an explosion, and it blew out both my eardrums. I was bleeding from my eardrums, my nose, and one of my eyes. And that wasn't very much fun. So it was pretty dangerous. Kind of a defining moment. Got out of the Marine Corps after 6 years. I was a captain. And I came back to Atlanta. I got married. And I was 35 when I got married. And that was still too young, believe it or not. I could have waited a few more years. You got that. Thank you. Somebody's got it. Anyway, I married a girl. Cute girl, smart. She's a pharmacist. We had two kids, twin boys. They'll be 30 in October. And it was about 2 years. After about 2 years, my kids were about 6 years old. Six months old. And I was like, man, this is a bad idea. Like I said, 35 was too old. Maybe if I'd have waited until 40, it wouldn't have been so bad. But we stayed married 20 years, and I was unhappy for probably 18 of them. I mean, I would think 15 of 20 years I slept in a separate room. And I remember reading somewhere that once your kids get to about five or six, they kind of have their values sort of set. They know, you know, right from wrong. And I thought, well, God, if I can just make it till five or six, you know, then I'll get divorced and, you know, they'll be better off. Then they started playing sports. I started coaching, doing all that kind of stuff. And it was pretty fun. And I said, well, I'll just let them get to teenagers, you know, and then if they're, you know, if they're going to be screwed up, at least I can, you know, see what's going on. I ended up making until they were about 17. Now, keep in mind, this whole time, I'd been drinking. And my wife, my drinking started, and I drank all the way through the Marine Corps, but I never was. I mean, everybody drinks hard in the Marine Corps. It's just what you do. And, but we would go, I would go months and months and months when I was in the Marine Corps and never have a drink and never even think about it. And so I don't think being an alcoholic, I probably was still an alcoholic, but it just hadn't taken hold of me. And so I can remember when we first got married, I started drinking. And I'd have a drink, you know, one drink. And then that drink just started getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And then finally, you know, I'd drink, you know, a margarita with, you know, 15 ounces of tequila in it. And thinking nobody knew how hammered I was, of course, that's not true. Somewhere, I remember in 2006, we went on this trip, and I came back, and I'd stopped drinking for a while. I started back, and I thought, well, you know, I better start hiding this, because my wife is none too happy about my drinking. So I started being a basement drinker, and I would go down the basement. First off, I'd say, you know what, I'm going to fix something tonight. I'm going to fix this drawer. And I got to go to the basement and get the tools. So I go down there, throw back about 10 quick shots of tequila, come back up, and I say, you know what, damn it, I need another pair of pliers. And then, I run back down there and do about another 10 shots. Well, by the time I get back, I'm like, screw it, I don't want to work on the desk anymore. So anyway, it was just a big guy. My wife, you know, knowing my parents, my wife was always riding my ass about drinking. And, you know, I look back at it now, and, you know, I'm a prideful person, but, you know, my pride wouldn't let me see that I was a drunk. And it was never suggested that, hey, let's try Alcoholics Anonymous. That was never brought up. My wife was like, you're a drunk, your parents are drunk, your sisters are drunk, you're just an alcoholic. And so that's why I hid it. I tried to hide it as much as possible. But, you know, I look back and, you know, had my pride just said, well, you know, it's probably not normal to do 15 shots of tequila before dinner. You know, maybe some kind of treatment would work, but my pride would never let me do that. And so, you know, we never got along. I wasn't going to let her be right about anything if I could help it. So we got divorced, and I started dating this girl after a few years, and she was actually a doctor. But she was my drinking buddy. She drank like me. I was like, hell, this is awesome. And I think really, when I look back at it, part of why I got divorced was because I wanted to be able to drink like I wanted to drink. I'm tired of somebody nagging me. I want to sit in my chair, get hammered, watch the Braves game, you know, whatever you do. Also, prior to that, one thing that didn't help is, like I told you, we had twin boys. When they were 16, one of them, we found gay pornography on his computer. And that was really, it was kind of he did it on purpose. But, you know, so that was sort of the beginning of that. My wife, her approach was, you know, we can fix this with Christian counseling. I'm like, what? Christian counseling? I was like, you know, you don't fix this. This is not a problem. You just love the boy the way he is, and you move on. And that was another part of the divorce. I mean, notwithstanding the part that stayed by myself for 15 years, but in a separate room. But anyway, I got divorced. The girl that I started dating, like I said, she was a physician. She had kids, 1, 3, and 4. And my friends were like, dude, what the fuck are you doing? And I'm like, I don't know. You know, she's sweet and smart and good looking. And so anyway, but even after time, I started to outdrink her. And she started saying to me, you know, that, you know, well, you are really drinking a lot. And, you know, I mean, all the way through my life, I was still a blackout drinker. I mean, I could watch Monday Night Football every Monday. I'd get up on Tuesday, and I'd have to look at my phone to see who played. I'd forget about the score. I had to see who played. I couldn't remember anything. I couldn't remember what I ate. I couldn't remember what I said. Couldn't remember what I did. And God bless you. The life with my girlfriend, Heather, it was good for quite a while. And then near the end, she started, you know, and like, wow, you know, you need to really quit drinking. And so we got to this point where, you know, she was like, why don't we try to quit together? That was the first time that it come up. And you know, by this point in time, you know, I knew I was an alcoholic. You know, you talk about step one. I didn't know anything about AA and the steps. And I didn't know what step one was. But I admitted to myself I was an alcoholic. But you know what? I couldn't do anything about it. I could not stop drinking. And, I mean, I would be drunk. I'd look myself in the mirror and say, all right, tomorrow's going to be the day. I'm going to get up tomorrow. I'm not going to drink. And, you know, I'd wake up every morning. I was sick as a dog. I threw up I'd take the dog out so I could go throw up behind the bushes every day. And I'd say, all right, today's going to be the day. I'm going to do it. I'm not going to drink. I always felt like if I could just do it one day, then I could maybe not drink another day. And then those two I could turn to 4, and those 4 I could turn to 8 and maybe stop drinking, but I could never do it. And you know, like I said at the beginning with, I'm a pretty religious person. I mean, I was going to church. I would sit, you know, after communion on my knees, and I'd pray, God, please stop. Help me stop drinking. God, please help me stop drinking. I'd say that over and over and over. And, you know, somehow I thought, well, I'm going to walk out of church and get just struck sober. It never worked. It never worked. But God did come into my life. And there was a time, it was between Christmas and New Year's on a Wednesday. And, you know, I was in the mortgage business, so it was kind of slow. And I was sitting there at the table, drunk, at about 8:15. And something happened. I was so beat down and so worn out that I picked up the phone and called Anchor Hospital. And they said, well, we'll take you. We're open 24 hours a day. But I was like, no, I'm not coming now. I'll come tomorrow at 1. How about that? You know, make an appointment. So I go down there at 1. Well, my plan is to check in and do what you got to do and then go back home, throw on one more good drunk, then go back on Friday. So I go down there and, you know, they check your insurance and all that. And I noticed, although I was down there voluntarily, every time they went in and out of the room, they locked the door. I was like, what's up with that? And so she comes back finally. She says, all right, we're gonna admit you. We're going to take you. And I said, all right, that's great. I said, what do? I go home and get my toothbrush and pajamas and stuff. And they're like, oh, no, honey, you're not going anywhere. And they didn't let me go for 10 days. And, I mean, here I was. I had to call my boss. This was the day before at the end of the month. I was in the mortgage business. I had all these loans closing. I had to call my boss and say, hey, boss, I'm an alcohol detox. You got to help me with these loans. He's like, what? And because I never had a problem at work. I never drank at work. And he was a friend of mine. But it was that's a pretty hard call to make. Anyway, I got out of, I was there for about 10 days. And I got out on a Friday. I went to my first real meeting, which was down at Triangle. It was a men's meeting at 9 o'clock. And, you know, I walk in and they hand me How It Works to read. And I'm like, you know, I've got this. So I read like 2 paragraphs. I'm like, do I have to read all of this? I'll read a couple more. I was like, do I have to read all of this? And they were like, yeah, come ask, read it all. And anyway, so then they made me share. They had this thing where they called on people they didn't know, so I had to share. But afterwards, this old timer came out there, and this was, you know, during the fall. And he said, well, what are you going to do today? I said, well, I'm going to watch football. He said, watch football. I said, yeah. I said, my son's coming over. I said, I have never watched a football game in 40 years that hadn't been drunk. I said, I don't know how I'm going to do it. I don't know how I'm going to go the rest of my life without drinking, watching football. And he said to me, you know, you don't have to go the rest of your life. You just have to go today. And that's pretty trite around here. Everybody's, oh, one day at a time. But I'd never heard that before. And I was like, wow, that sounds like a good idea. So I got home. I drank a glass of milk. My son drank a Coke. And I didn't drink. And I didn't even think about drinking. And that Saturday morning, he said, well, what are you going to do Sunday? I said, well, Falcons game. And same thing. I drank a glass of milk. My son drank a Coke. And I didn't drink. I didn't have one drink. I didn't even think about it. In fact, I picked up one white chip. And this program has done for me what nothing else could do. I have been sober about 6 years. When I first got sober, I quit work. My son had moved out to Wyoming. I've got some motorcycles, so I towed a couple of my motorcycles out to Wyoming. And so 3 months, I said, I'll be gone 3 months. And that turned to 6 months, and I was really gone about 18 months. And I didn't work. Then I came back. I didn't work for 3 years. But I used to go to probably 10 or 12 meetings a week. I loved it. I loved AA. I still love AA. It has just done for me what I couldn't do for myself. I love the fellowship that we have. I love knowing that you guys get me and I get you. And it's just been a great thing. I mean, I've got a sponsor. I was so naive about, and this was a friend of mine from church, and he'd been sober. He's 50, 53. He's been sober like 37 years. He got sober when he was 17. So I'm nervous wreck. I'm sitting with him at breakfast one morning, and I said, you know, Cam, would you be my sponsor? He's like, yeah, I'll be your sponsor, of course. And I said, I'm not kidding. I was like, well, what do I do? Do I have to go online and apply, or do I have to pay somebody for this? And he's like, no, dude, I'm your sponsor. And it was nerve-wracking, but it worked. And then after about a year, and I fought it, I got a sponsee. This guy's named Bobby. He's been sober about 4.5 years. He's a Delta pilot. And between Cam and especially Bobby, I probably wouldn't make any big decision in my life without talking to them first. And forget about drinking. I'm kind of past all that. I'm talking about, should I buy a car? Should I buy the one with the V8 and the four-wheel drive? Or should I buy this? You know, Bobby, like, analyzes all that stuff. And it's just nice to have somebody in your life that you can trust, that's there for you. So, anyway, one thing that I did, and I highly recommend this. I don't know if this is for everybody. There's this place in Atlanta, in Sandy Springs, called the Ignatius House. And it's a Jesuit monastery. And they have silent retreats. They have a lot of silent retreats. But they will have, periodically during the year, they'll have AA. And it's led by a priest. He's an alcoholic. And there's three. I've been to three of them. You go there Friday, you don't talk until Sunday. And I've been to one on steps 1, 2, and 3, one on steps 5 and or 6 and 7, and one on 11 and 12. And, you know, since then I've done a lot of reading. And so for me, the way I look at the steps is I use steps 1, 2, and 3 to make peace with God. I use steps 4, 5, 6, and 7 to make peace with myself. I use steps 8, 9, and 10 to make peace with others. And then I use steps 11 and 12 to keep the peace. And that's sort of the way I view life. And this is important to me. Talking to y'all was important to me, although I'm a nervous wreck to do it. I think I'll end there. And I appreciate y'all listening to me. I'll just leave this here and get it later.
Yeah, sure.
Strange to me, as I rode from town to town, can't put the bottle down, right now feels like it's killing me, life out here gets so depressing, need something to take the edge, you see. It's the Bible, the book, or the gun for me. Seems like everyone's out to get me. Trouble always following me. Feeling like
Bible, the book, or the gun for me.